I'm Frank Gallagher, host of Soundman Confidential. It's showtime. Plug in. A Soundman Confidential today, an artist who in the 70s in England blazed a trail that was unique with a style and performance that's still going on today. From Grosse Pointe Farms, Detroit, please welcome Suzy Quatro. My guest today has 15 or more studio albums. She sold over 50 million records worldwide. And it's my pleasure to talk to Suzy Quatro.
And how are you?
I'm fabulous today, fabulous.
Yeah, good. It's good to talk to you. I mean, we go back a long way.
Well, I wasn't going to mention that till later on, but we go back a long way.
We do.
My producer says, don't make it personal, you know.
Okay.
It's kind of hard not to make it personal when I know you, you know.
It is.
I've been on trains and planes and buses with you and vans.
So come
back to the beginning for people who don't know you. And also, I didn't know too much about your early days, really, in Detroit, coming up. You were formally trained, I believe, at one point.
Yes. Potted family history. My father was a semi-pro musician all his life. He was a child prodigy on violin. He had five kids. We all took, basically whatever kind of musical instrument we wanted to play. I read, write, and play classical piano, read, write, and play percussion. And we all of the five kids kind of play, I would say, minimum three instruments each. It's not a big deal in my family, just the way it was. So that was where I came from. Family shows, learned how to entertain, and started being professional at the age 14 in band.
And this was in Detroit.
Yeah, this is in Detroit, where I was born and raised, yeah.
Did the local music filter through to you, the Motown stuff, did that filter down to your neighborhood at all?
Oh, my God, yeah. I'm actually a Motown fanatic. I was a 60s teenager at the best time of Motown ever, you know, so weaned on all the great Motown acts. I used to dance on a TV show, and I would see them, like, three inches in front of me performing, and the bass player Jamerson from the Funk Brothers, he was a big influence on my style. I'm known as being a Motown fanatic. I just am.
Yeah, me too. What's not to like? Did that propel you towards the bass guitar, or growing up in a musical family, you had your pick of instruments?
No, it was kind of strange how it happened, because, like I said, I'd already studied piano and percussion. It was quite good at both. And then when we started the band, we started it with a couple of friends of ours who were also sisters and another girl. And everybody sort of spoke up about what instrument they wanted to play. It was Patty's idea, my eldest sister. She said, let's have an all-girl band. We all went, yeah, great idea. Da, 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 da. Everybody grabbed an instrument on the telephone. And I kind of went, hello, what am I supposed to play? And my sister Patty said, you're playing bass. And already being percussion and piano, it wasn't that big of a leap, because those, you know, piano is a percussive instrument. So I said, fine. I didn't care what I played. And I got a bass from my father. I asked him if he had one, because we were starting a band. And he went we had instruments all over the house. He gave me a 1957 Fender Precision to learn and play the bass on. So I got given the Rolls Royce of bass guitars to begin playing. I had no idea. Everybody says, why didn't I pick a smaller bass? I didn't know there was a smaller bass. All I had was what my dad gave me. So I figured, okay, this is what I have to learn.
Fantastic. And you still have it?
I do. In fact, I use it in the studio. I built a home studio about a year and a half ago, and a little demo studio, and it sits out there now. It did used to be on my wall, but my son, who I've worked with on the last two albums, he said, this needs to be in the studio. So it's now in the studio.
Fantastic. And did you and apparently you played drums in your dad's band as well at one point for a minute.
Bongo drums.
Oh, you played the bongos.
Bongo drums was actually my very, very first instrument. My father got me my first pair when I was about 7. And he used to let me come along to his gigs and play in front of his trio. So that was great. I'm pretty good on the bongos. I played on both albums. The last two albums I did with my son, if you look at the credits, it says percussion. That's me.
Did as a child, I suppose growing up with it, going on stage was no big deal, no stage fright.
Oh my God, no!
Didn't
In
care.
Fact, it's more weird not going on stage. it's a real natural habitat for me, and I guess it would be, you know, after so many years, you know what I mean. So I remember the first time I did the gig with the band. When I was 14, and we learned 3 songs to do a little quick spot at the local dance hall. And the guy said we could go on and do 3 songs, so we did. And I remember standing up there with my bass guitar on and going to start. And in my head, I said, I'm home. I'm home.
That's great. That's great. So your relationship when you sonically speaking, when you picked up the bass, and the bass and the drums, the rhythm section, have to lock in. Were you conscious of that when you started playing bass guitar, that the drummer was your buddy and that was the idea? What's your take on the relationship between the bass and drummer thing?
Yes, I was conscious of that. In fact, when I go on stage, I make it a point to say that without the bass and drums, you got nothing.
Yep.
And that's my opinion, because we're the engine. That's how I feel about it. You got to lock in with the drummer, and if you don't, then it's not a good rhythm section. And the fact that I already played percussion and piano, like I said, which is a percussive instrument, so I'm very aware of that relationship between bass and drums, very aware of it. And one of the nicest compliments I ever received, actually, was from the drummer I had before this one. He had bad asthma, and he finally had to stop. We were talking in a bar, you know, after a gig, and we were talking about various styles of playing and da-da-da-da-da. And he said to me, Susie, whatever you play on the bass is always correct. And that was like the nicest compliment I ever received.
Was that Dave?
Yeah. And in fact, it happened twice, though, because I don't know if you remember Steve Cropper.
Yes.
Great guitar player from the, yep, they're just great. Did all Otis Redding stuff and, you know, fabulous. And Doc of the Bay and all that kind of stuff. And we were talking. We met at an award ceremony, and we got talking. And I said, I got a little confession. And he said, what? And I said, well, sometimes I put on an album to jam to when I feel like it. He said, yeah. And I said, for some reason, and it's only happened 2 times in my life, it's with you and what are they called? What are they called? The bar case? No, the... Oh, God. Green Onions. Who made Green Onions?
Booker T and the MGs.
Yeah. I said, when I put on Otis's albums with Donald Duck Dunn on bass, I end up playing, without knowing it, exactly the same bass lines as him. And it just always surprises me. And he said, well, there's a reason you do that, Susie. I said, okay, what's the reason? He said, because they're correct. And that really made me laugh. So, yeah, I'm not a failed guitar player. I never went from guitar to bass. I started on bass. So, and that also is a different attitude when you think about it. You know, a lot of times you do get failed guitar players. Oh, I can't make it on guitar, so I'll take 2 less strings and do the bass. It's not the same thing as being an organic bass player.
Yeah. So you were in a band with your sisters, an all-female band of the Pleasure Seekers. What was the dynamic like there? Was there a leader, or was it a family collective?
There wasn't a leader, no. It really was just a band of girls. It was 2 sisters to begin with, me and Patty, and then when we lost our second keyboard player, my dad said, put your other sister in, because she plays piano, and what are you looking for a keyboard player for? So that's what we did. So then it was 3 sisters. No, there was never a leader. Although Patty did take charge of rehearsal times and that kind of stuff, yeah, because she's an organized girl, so she did that. But there was no leader as such, no.
And where, what kind of places did you play with the Pleasure Seekers back then? What kind of gigs
did
you get?
At the beginning, 14, 15, we played all the local dance halls and, you know, schools and colleges and all that kind of thing. And then when my elder sister joined, her husband started to manage the band, and he had to support three kids on it. So we started the club circuit, the nightclub circuit, and we did very well on that. And it was a case of 5 sets a night, 45 on, 15 off, and talk about learning your craft. You know, there's no better training in the world than learning like that. So, yeah, we were a show band for many, many years.
And how long did that last?
The Pleasure Seekers ran from 64 to 70 to 1970, and then it reformed as a band called Cradle, still all girls. Who bought my elder sister left, and my younger sister came in to sing. So I moved back a bit, you know, took the back seat instead of the main front person. And that lasted for about 18 months until Mickey came and offered me my solo contract. I was never, excuse me, never as happy in Cradle as I was in the Pleasure Seekers. I didn't like that band so much.
And Mickey being Mickey Most for
yes, Mickey Most, yeah.
Those people who don't know. And now what was your, so tell us about the Mickey Most introduction.
It's just strange how it happened because the band was doing what they were doing. Like I said, I took a little bit of a back seat, and we were writing all our own material, getting heavier, getting serious, doing a lot of jamming, blah, 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 blah. And the Elektra Records came to see the band, and they didn't like the band, and they offered me a solo contract. And the very exact same week, Mickey Most came over to Detroit to record Jeff Beck at Motown, and he also came to see the band, and he also didn't want the band and only wanted me, so I had 2 solo offers in 1 week, which means it's your time to go. Your time to go. So I made my decision to go to England because Elektra Records, they wanted me to go to New York and become the next Janis Joplin, and Mickey Most said, come to England and you become the first Susie Quattro, so that's where I went.
Good move. Very good move. I met you at that point before anything came out with Mickey at the helm. But you were living in London at that point. For how long before?
I arrived October 71, and we kept recording different people. We were trying to find our way forward with me. Mickey wasn't quite sure what to do with me. In fact, he wasn't sure at all. I mean, he knew what I wasn't. He didn't know what I was. And by May of 73, I had my first number one. So about 18 months.
Yeah, I was
not there. Not bad. Not bad at all.
Not bad. And you were living in a hotel somewhere.
In a hotel. Yeah, I was
down the Cromwell Road.
By Mickey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I even know that hotel.
And
that's when I bumped into you through Len Tuckey, who I had been working with the Nashville Teens.
That's right.
And somehow I think through Keith Hodge, the drummer, at that point.
Keith Hodge. I had fired my American guitar player. He had left. I can't remember anyway. Something happened, and Keith suggested this friend of his called Len Tuckey, and I thought, oh no, not a friend of somebody, and I wasn't for it. But then he came over quite late at night, I think at about midnight. He got out of his flat, got dressed, took the underground, came to Keith's house, and then we ended up at the rehearsal rooms, and we did a Chuck Berry, and I'd found my guitar player and my future husband.
All in one.
All in one go. There you go.
Buy one, get one free.
Yep.
Mike Chapman and Nicky Chinn, my introduction to you was Tuckey said to me, Len Tuckey said, you want to come and help us out doing a few gigs here. And so at that point, I didn't drive. I think Hodgie drove the transit van or we did a few gigs here and there. And
yeah, we did a college circuit. Mickey put us on.
Yeah, East Anglia, and we poodled around there. And I was just struck. And at this point, you were still wearing jeans and you were denim clad, shall we say, pretty much on stage. jeans and a jacket before the leather period. And I remember that coming along too. How did Mickey figure? How much hands-on was Mickey in the development of your career there, the early career?
Well, Mickey was always searching, like I said. He wasn't good with me in the studio, and he was the first one to say so. And he just didn't know how to record me. But it was me that insisted that I had a band. I said, I'm going crazy here. I've always been a working artist. So he said, okay, get a band. I got a band. We started gigging, and then, you know, it really started to come forward who I was and what I was, because it was all my own songs that we did. And then Mickey put us on the opening act of the first National Slade tour, and Chaz Chandler did it as a favor to Mickey, and I had 15 minutes at the beginning of the show. So that was when the band really pulled together, because, you know, you're doing night after night after night. Then we got our sound, we got our image, everything started to happen. We all knew who we were. And then he brought Chin and Chapman on board to say, can they listen to your set, because it was all original material, and possibly write you that magical hit single based on what you're doing already. And that's what they did. And then, because Mickey's smart, he had the record, and he said to Mike, I think you should produce it too. So Mickey then handed over the reins. So he knew that he wasn't getting me in the studio. He was smart enough to know that.
Yeah, it was just a dynamic thing and a style thing with Mickey?
He just didn't... He knew who I was exactly. I mean, we were very close, but he just didn't get me recording-wise. He didn't get it. Even the one album he did, Agoraphobia, because I was in between. Mike Chapman had run away to America, and he didn't want to work with anybody. He was being a bit weird, and I had a contractual album due to come out. Mickey produced one album with me, and even that is not who I am. So Mickey, in the studio, just doesn't get me, and he knew it. Otherwise, he wouldn't have asked Mike to produce the first single.
Yeah, I remember hearing the single. I think we rehearsed in the basement at Rack. I think that was the first time I had that song.
Yeah, yeah, we rehearsed downstairs at Rack. Mike brought this demo in of him screeching and screechy guitars, and we all got down to the whole band, and we worked it all up and made the arrangement, and everybody put their 2 cents in, you know, and it was magic, I got to say, really magic.
Yeah, I remember it. I remember on first hearing thinking... And even hearing his demo, you know, and I've subsequently heard demos that he did for Sweet as well, you know, that came out.
Mike used to make these unbelievably noisy demos.
Yeah.
but he would get the song across. That's the main thing.
I think he made them with an old Revox, recorded with a knitting needle, you know, stuck in there.
Yep.
And so yeah, I actually was fortunate enough to see Mickey a few years ago. I was visiting Rack Studios in London, and before he passed, and he was always a gracious man to me. Always a gracious man. But he knew a hit. That was the other thing about Mickey Most. He knew what a hit was.
What, Mickey?
Yeah. And that's,
oh, God, yeah. And that's, Mickey had excellent ears, and he could spot a star. He was good at, you know, saying that person's got it. And he was good at putting the right record with the right artist and framing it in the right frame. He had all those qualities. But Mickey knew a good song really, really good. Yeah, he always used to say within 30 seconds.
Yeah.
It either hits me or it doesn't.
Yeah. He also told me once, there's no song, there's nothing to do, you know. You ain't got the song, yeah. There's nothing to do. No amount of production can save a project if there's no song.
Yes, it's either right or wrong. It's either a hit or it's not a hit. And when we heard Can the Can, even the demo, we knew that was a hit song. And when we put the record down, we knew, you know, hairs on the back of the neck. I knew I was sitting on a hit, absolutely.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And from that point, it was 0 to 60 in milliseconds, because it just took off and across Europe and across the world.
I mean, Can the Can sold 2.5 million records, just that song.
Wow, yeah.
Amazing, yeah.
It was a bit of a whirlwind for me, being involved in something like that. the workload went up somewhat, but we had
oh yeah, oh god, well we started the tour nonstop. It's constant. I had constant jet lag.
I look at my old passport and from those days, because everywhere you went, you got a stamp.
No, it's incredible. It's incredible. I have all my old passports too. It's amazing how much I worked, you know, and still now to this day.
Yeah, yeah.
Except for COVID, you know, I've been nonstop. I mean, I still do like 100 gigs a year.
Yeah, people say to me, "Well, Frank, you're over 70 now."
But I like what I do, so there you go.
Yeah, well, people
say, "That's the bonus."
Why are you still doing this? Because that's what I do. That's what we do. Well, that's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what else can I do? You know, it's been 58 years now. What else can I do?
And we love it.
That's what I do. But luckily, I've spread myself out. You know, I mean, I'm an actress. I'm a DJ. I'm an author. I'm on my sixth book now. So it's not just that. So I have to be an artiste. I have to be a total communicator in all the artistic pursuits. That's how I'm happy.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us about your West End experience. How did that come about?
Oh, that was great.
How did that come about?
Andrew Lloyd Webber was always on at me to do a musical. He always wanted me to do something. And I've always had my eye on everything. You know, I mean, Happy Days, I was in that for 3 seasons. And so I always wanted to act as well. I want to do it all that artistically I can do. And I always knew I could act. But that offer came to me. Funny enough, the guy that was putting the Annie Get Your Gun on at Chichester, he was in New York. And he had dinner with Andrew Lloyd Webber, and they were talking shop. And Andrew said, "What are you doing next?" And he said, "I'm doing Annie Get Your Gun." And Andrew said, who's playing Annie? And he said, "I don't know. I'm here in New York looking for somebody." He said, "Well, you made a trip you didn't need to make. She lives in Essex." And he said, "Who?" He said, "Susie Quattro." And he went, "Oh, my God." And he came back and called me, and I got the part.
Just like that.
Yeah, well, yeah. Because, I mean, it suits me.
Yeah.
I mean, those songs and everything, you know, it's you couldn't get a better part for me, could you?
Brilliant, brilliant. Looking back then, Can the Can came out. It was massive all over, you know. We started doing Europe, up and down the autobahns very quickly. And what about it didn't make such an impact in America that I can remember at that point. Do you think there was a reason for that? That it didn't explode?
If you want to know the real good ins and outs of that, it's really explained properly in Susie Q, the documentary, which came out at the end of 2019, did great all around the world, top of these Amazon charts. But there was a little space there of these records that were big everywhere and not transferring to America. There's about 18 months. Nobody knows why. As Mike Chapman says in my documentary, they missed something in America, just in that little space. I don't know why, but I did notice when we started touring there in 74, that when I turned on the radio, it was either the Eagles or Linda Ronstadt, and that was it. So the prognosis is, everybody has talked about it, that I was probably a little bit early for America. They accepted me everywhere else, but a little bit early for America. So I didn't have the hit singles there, but I sold albums, and I was known, and I toured, of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because, you know, and how do you stay motivated? What motivates you to get out of bed in the morning and put the cushions out?
Well, it's not difficult for me. I'm a creative person, and these times especially. I mean, if I'm not writing the song, I'm working on my next novel, which I am. I'm always motivated. I don't need pushing. I'm just always on. I love what I do. I love creation, and every day is a new adventure for me.
Yeah, and you're also famously quoted as saying that you don't care about the charts these days, that you just keep
nobody
working.
Nobody does, really.
Regardless.
No, nobody does. I mean, this album that's out now, The Devil and Me, that charted everywhere and just had embarrassingly good reviews. It's my second album with my son. I mean, embarrassingly good. People went nuts on this album. I've never read such compliments in my life. So, yeah, it has charted, but you don't live by the charts anymore. That kind of music business doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you get your records out, you make your videos, they do a lot of streaming, you know what I mean? It's just not important like it used to be. It used to be the chart and Top of the Pops or whatever, American Bandstand, but it's not like that anymore.
Yeah, and back when they first I remember the leather suit and the Jerry Mankiewicz photo sessions and stuff. The gender identity in rock and roll was a big thing. The gender war was a big thing.
Yeah, but I didn't pay any attention to that whatsoever. But what I take to Mary Grave is I was the first female to have worldwide success leading a band playing an instrument. I take that to my grave. But I didn't know I was doing that. I was just being me. And with gender, if you want to talk about gender, I have to talk about it sometimes, but I don't do gender, and I never have. I never, ever thought of myself as a female musician, not for a millisecond. I'm a musician. Done.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't pay attention to any, if it was a boys' club, I didn't see it. And I didn't care, actually. I didn't care. I was just, you know how I am. You knew me from long ago. Have I ever been female that way? No, never. I'm one of the guys. But I'm a woman, but I'm one of the guys.
Yeah, you certainly are.
I am. Always have been.
Going back a wee bit to the Happy Days experience.
Yeah.
How did you get that?
Okay, the story was they knew that they were going to have contractual difficulties with the girl that played Pinky, and they liked the Tuscadero thing. That was my older sister in the show, so they tried to see how they could keep that character going, maybe as a younger sister, and they came up with this part for Leather Tuscadero. Then they started to find somebody to play her, and they couldn't find it. They were looking, and they wanted somebody who could be tough and vulnerable and who was cute and could sing and act, and that's what they were looking for. And the casting lady went into her daughter's bedroom, and she saw my picture on the cover of Rolling Stone, and she said, "Who's that? That's who we want." And they called me in Japan, and my publicist, Toby Mamus at the time, he said, "Can you come over and audition for the show?" I didn't know the show. He said, "Believe me, you want to do it. It's a cool show." I said, "Okay." So I flew over from Japan to L.A., got the part, and it lasted for 3 seasons. So that is quite a compliment.
It is. It is, indeed. And you were in Minder as well.
I did quite a few things. I did Minder, Dempsey and Makepeace, Midsummer Murders, Ab Fab. So I've branched out. I've done Andy Get Your Gun, and I've also written a musical about Tallulah Bankhead called Tallulah Who, and I played Tallulah. Been on BBC Radio 2 for 15 years as a DJ, so I'm one of these wide range artists.
This should be more like you. I'm just looking for a quote that you said to, before I did what I did, we didn't have a place in rock and roll, not really. You had your Grace Slick and all that, but that's not what I did.
Yeah, it was, I didn't have a blueprint, okay? There was nobody that I could see that came before me that's what I wanted to do. Not female anyway, even though I don't do gender. I didn't have, so I just had to make, because I didn't fit anywhere. That's the whole truth of it. There was no niche that I fit into. So what happens when that happens to you is you find your own niche. And so I invented a new one, which is the niche that is me. And then everybody followed after that. And in the documentary, so many women are there, coming up and saying, "Oh, my God, we wouldn't have even thought about doing what we do if it hadn't been for Susie." And the funniest thing is I went to the first premiere in London at the end of 2019 of Susie Q. And it was a Q&A, And I was due to come up at the end of the thing and answer questions on stage. And I wanted to see the documentary with an audience, so I snuck into the theater and stood on the side that nobody saw me. And, of course, a couple of people did, but I went, shh. And I'm watching the film, the documentary, and I'm in tears because it's quite something to see your life up on the screen there. It's quite emotional. And I called my friend, Cherie Curry, who was lead singer from the Runaways. I called her the next day, and I said to her, I've got to share something with you. And she said, "What?" And I said, "Well, I went to the premiere last night, and I just realized something." And she said, "What?" I said, "I just realized that by me doing what I did, I gave permission to women all over the world to be different." And there was a long silence, and she said, "And you just got that?" Yeah. And it shows you, that's what I'm trying to say. I'm illustrating that because I didn't have an agenda. I didn't think, I'm going to do this for women. It didn't occur to me that I was doing anything different. All I was doing was being who I am and not changing for anybody. And that's what made the difference.
Fantastic. Is there anything you wish you had known at the outset of your career?
That
you know now, you know what I mean? It's just...
No, I mean, my father was, you know, he pretty much gave me my work ethic because he pulled me aside. I think I was about 16. I always tell this story because it's important. He pulled me aside and he said, Susie, you know, you're serious about this, what you're doing? I said, yeah, you can see I'm serious. And he said, okay, I want to talk to you. I said, yes. He said, this, what you're doing, is a profession. I said, yes. He said, now, he said, if you go on stage to 10 people or 10,000, what you have to remember is every single person in that audience took money out of their pocket and paid to see you. And you owe them. You owe them. And if you don't go on the stage and give 200%, you have no business being out there. And he gave me that, and you know me from days of old. That's what I do. I give 200%. And he gave me that work ethic, and it stuck with me my entire career. If there's one person, it could be 14,000 people, if there's one person not going, I will find him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Susie, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And
my pleasure.
And it's good that we're still talking to each other after all these years.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Frank.
Thank
you. We'll speak soon, huh?
All right. Okay, all right. I'll be in touch. Hey, thanks for plugging in. We can't do without you. And if you can, please consider supporting the show so that we can keep it running through 2021. Go to our website at soundmanconfidential.com to find the link and to check out our amazing upcoming guest list. Soundman Confidential is produced by Alan Black, Chet Bentley, and Michael Manson. Web design by Adelaide Bell. Social media by Mackenzie Chase. Publicity by Paddy DeVries at Devious Planet Media.